We're looking tonight, as we continue, we'll review a little bit because it has been a while since we've looked at this. Last week we talked about the first step toward getting the church to grow. And we're going to take a step back now and look at some things that are needed for church growth, past and present. What we're really doing here is we're comparing people's conception of what we need to have to get the church to grow today, and comparing that to that time in the first century when the church was growing. And what we're finding is, as we look at these things, and we've already looked at a few of them, we'll go through those real quickly to catch everybody up, because I know some weren't here the last time, and for the rest of us, we may have forgotten because it's been a while. So we'll look at those. But the idea is that we think we need things to help the church grow, or we think certain things will help the church grow. And that's very different than the reality of what happened in the first century when the church was growing. And we looked at last time at a few things that the church had in the first century and what we have today. And we found that really the things we have today are an advantage, or at least they should be an advantage to us. Unfortunately, we often turn those things that should be blessings and advantages into hindrances, and we use them as excuses to not do the things that were done in the first century to spread the gospel. So I want to look at those. So on the left side is going to be the things that we think are necessary today, and on the right side are going to be the things that they had in the first century as we go down through here. So first of all, we think an excellent public speaker, somebody who's debonair and suave and eloquent and all of those things, and yet in the first century, they weren't the eloquent, great speakers. You had some, like Apollos. Apollos was well known as being a great speaker, but it's mentioned that he was because some of the others weren't. In Acts 4:13, they saw that Peter and John, were uneducated, ignorant men. They were unlearned. They hadn't been to school. They hadn't learned this stuff, but they noticed they'd been with Jesus. Now certainly we know Jesus had the ability to captivate a crowd. The people were amazed by the way he spoke. But the disciples, not so much. Paul has said of him in 2 Corinthians 10:10, his speech is contemptible. In other words, he can't talk good. He wasn't an eloquent speaker. And yet the church was growing. We might say in spite of that, not necessarily because of that. There's nothing wrong with having someone trained to do public speaking. That's not wrong. That actually should be something that would help us to have more of an influence than they did. But sometimes we put so much of the focus on the eloquence and on the wisdom of man's words and all those kinds of things, and we forget that the power is in the gospel. It's not in the man that's speaking them. And anyone who's speaking the truth is going to be able to have an impact on souls. So the second thing we looked at was that we think that we got to have a nice building, it's got to be in the right location, and that's a blessing to be able to have that, but they certainly didn't have that in the first century. They didn't have any church buildings. They were meeting in borrowed rooms, they were meeting in these different homes of the members and all these kinds of things. So they didn't have that. Acts 17, 1-3, it talks a little bit about how they were meeting in the synagogue of the Jews and borrowing rooms and renting rooms. Paul, at one point, taught in a school, the school of Tyrannus. And so he taught in that school. And so we think, oh, we got to have this. In fact, I've seen that even in church growth studies throughout the religious world. This idea, well, if we built a new building, or if we went to this kind of, and one of the things that they said about it is, the building doesn't make the church. It doesn't matter how nice the building is if the people that are in it are fussing and fighting with each other. And it doesn't matter how pitiful the meeting place is, or whether it's a borrowed one or a rented one, or whatever, if the people that are meeting there love the Lord and love one another. They can carry on in those circumstances. So even though, again, it's a blessing, it's a wonderful thing to have if you can have it, but that's not the focal point of the gospel and of the Bible. The third thing is businessmen in leadership. We think a lot of time, you know, we really need somebody who knows business and knows the way around. And I know, you know, tax laws and stuff have gotten really complicated and all these kind of things, and for the church to keep, you know, non-profit status and all these things, I understand why we think, oh, this is really a helpful thing. And again, it can be a very beneficial thing, but they certainly didn't have it in the first century. Had a lot of fishermen, a lot of poor people who needed help and things financially, and weren't necessarily the pillars of the community. They weren't the ones who had all of the business acumen. But that wasn't what the church was about. We have to remember that even if we have businessmen in our leadership in the church is not a business. And it's not to be run like a business. It's to be run as the family of God. It's His church. It's His family. It's not a business. And so sometimes we may get sidetracked there, and we may take something that could be a benefit and turn it into a liability instead. The fourth one, the last one that we had looked at the last time we were on this subject, is all comfort and convenience. You know, what would we do if we had to go back to those days when we had to sit on the hard wooden pews? I grew up on those hard wooden pews. My kids, I don't think, know what a hard wooden pew is. They've never seen one except this one, the half-broken one that's out here. You know, that idea that, oh, well, we've got to have the padded pews, we've got to have the air conditioning, you know, we've got to have a baptistry right in the building. I think we talked about the late 1800s, one of the preachers was talking about how he had to get off his horse and go across the river because it was frozen, but it wasn't frozen enough for his horse to get across it. And then he had to walk like 10 miles to get to where he was preaching the meeting. He got there, and a young lady came forward, wanted to be baptized. A teenage young lady came forward, wanted to be baptized. They had to go break 7 inches of ice out of the river to baptize her. Is it a blessing to have a baptistry? Yeah. It's nice. But again, these comforts and conveniences can become something that distracts us from the purpose of the church, which is not to be comfortable, but to be uncomfortable, to get outside our comfort zone to try to tell other people about Jesus. So those are the ones that we looked at. And kind of along those lines, we come to the fifth one, which is a lot of money. Oh, with the church, we got to have money for this, and we've got to have money for that. And I know money makes the world go round. I got bills just like the rest. I understand. And we all understand that money is a necessity. But a lot of times in the first century churches, they didn't have a lot of money. In fact, what we read about the churches of Macedonia, for example, that gave beyond their ability. Out of their poverty, they still gave to help feed the hungry saints. Sometimes when we have a lot, we're kind of like those scribes and Pharisees that were dropping bags of money in, but it didn't mean anything to them. And Jesus said, you know, yeah, they're giving out of their abundance. But look at that little widow who's not rich, who doesn't have anything, and she's giving all that she has. And this idea somehow, now, is it helpful to have money when it comes to giving missionaries money and supporting the work of the church and giving out Bibles and tracts and all these kinds of things that we might do and putting on a campaign like the Reach North Georgia campaign? They were talking at the meeting yesterday about how much the total cost for that's going to be, and my eyes about bugged out. You know, how much all of the, you know, renting the facility and paying for the speakers to come in and printing all these posters and flyers and doing all sorts of, and all these things. That, yes, it takes money. But in the first century, what money they did have was used primarily for taking care of those that were needy in the church and then spreading the gospel in one way or another, either by someone who was preaching and teaching or by, you know, helping to pay for travel for different things or whatever. And so that's the kind of thing that we see in the first century. And yet they were growing. That tells us that money is not the be-all, end-all for church growth. And I've seen a lot of rich churches that weren't growing. And I've seen some poor churches that were growing. You know, it's not about the money. Again, we talk about the power is in the gospel. The power is in being obedient to God. And then number six, I have expensive here, but maybe fancy, nice, really great Bible class material. And certainly what we're teaching from the Bible is important, that it's quality. But the quality is not in pretty pictures and cutouts and coloring pages and these kind of things for the kids and for the adults, the fancy-bound class books or something like that. We don't have to have that. In fact, in the first century, they didn't even have the completed New Testament yet. They were still working from the Old Testament, and of course, they had the advantage that we don't have of having prophets and those that were led by the Holy Spirit directly, miraculously, to be able to teach and preach these things and prophesy and all these kind of things. So they had that advantage, so that they didn't need the completed framework of the teachings that we have in the New Testament. But in 1 Corinthians 13 and verses 8 through 10, he talks about the fact that these miraculous gifts are going to pass away. The knowing in part is going to be done away. The prophesying in part is going to be done away. The tongues are going to cease. All of this is going to vanish away. And that's not going to last. But they did not even have completed New Testament. And sometimes we pick on them a little bit about, well, why did they have, you talk about Corinth there, why did they have all those problems they had? There's a chance, a good chance, that when Paul wrote this letter, this first one especially, to the Corinthians, yes, he had been there and preached and taught them. Apollos had been through Corinth and preached and taught as well. Others had been through Corinth and preached and taught some things. But there's a good chance they'd never read one of the gospel accounts, much less all four of them like we have. There's a good chance they'd never read a single one of them. They hadn't read the letter to the Romans or the Hebrews or Revelation or any of they hadn't read any of those. This letter of 1 Corinthians, at the time they received it, was the only written thing outside of the Old Testament that they had access to. And yet, they were able to grow, and they were able to correct problems, and they were able to learn things. It was not for a couple hundred years before all of those letters from all the different churches got gathered together into one book like that. That wasn't something they had access to. And so, we look at them and say, well, why didn't they know better than that? Well, they hadn't been taught better, for one thing. They hadn't, it was brand new. They'd been taught some things, they obeyed those things, and they started putting those into practice, but then they got off track because they didn't have some of that guidance. That's what these letters to the churches that we're now reading, that we have the benefit of, that we've had for all of our lives, but they were getting them a little bit at a time as they needed that correction and as they needed that teaching. And of course, we did mention again, they did have those prophets and various ones that had the wisdom and knowledge miraculously through the Spirit that was a big help to them. They had to have that. How would they have done anything if they hadn't had that miraculous help from the Holy Spirit to get started? But as we think about those things, it's pretty impressive that they did as well as they did. And it kind of is a shame on us that we're not doing better. Because again, we have so much advantage over them in that area. They didn't have decades of faithful Christians that had written on different subjects and studied on different subjects. They didn't have all of the study helps that we have of, whether it's not just commentaries, but things like a concordance to find a verse on a certain topic. They didn't have any of those things. They just had their faith in God, and then, of course, those that did have some miraculous abilities to prophesy and teach. But then again, if you come together on Sunday and the prophet gets up and preaches some prophecy and does some teaching for 30 minutes or an hour or however long they did at those times. And then you go home. You can't just go and Monday morning go read your Bible. Oh, you could read the Old Testament scriptures and try to find the prophecies about Jesus or things like that. But you couldn't pick it up and read about the life of Christ. You didn't have it. You couldn't pick it up and read about how the church in Ephesus was taught about unity or about the armor that we're to wear or about how we're not wrestling against flesh and blood. You didn't have that. Another one of the reasons probably that they did meet regularly from day to day to continually be encouraged by one another. They couldn't go to the scriptures. They weren't there. They weren't written. So that's something sometimes I think we forget that. And we're unfair to them because of that. But the Bible says, to whom much is given, much will be required. We in America, as Christians, have been given much. We've got so many blessings, so many advantages. Had a brother from India ask me about some Bible material, some class material, any kind of material to help understand the Bible better or to help teach the Bible better. We've got hundreds of preachers in India that are doing the best they can do with what they've got. They don't have all the advantages we have in the United States. They can't just call up 21st century Christian and say, ship us 20 more of these books, this class book or something. Well, I mean, they could if they had the money, but they don't have the money. This brother, a couple that I conversed with occasionally, one of them, he works full time for what amounts to about, in our money, $30 a week. He works full time at that, and then when he gets off work, then he goes and preaches. That's tough. Can't imagine how we would live if we got $30 a week. We probably wouldn't do too well. But, you know, there's a lot of that kind of thing. So I went through and found we get some extra duplicate books that we hadn't used, different class books and things, boxed those up to get them ready to send to him. But, that we weren't using them anyway. We got a library back there full of books that brethren have written over the past decades. And they just sit there. Nobody even checks them out, takes them home, reads them. We've got an abundance of riches. Not just financially, but of the material that we have access to, the books and the teaching that we can get to. And this doesn't even get into all the things that are now available with the internet and everything, where, you know, used to be if there was a lectureship once a year, you know, and you could get to it, that was the only time you'd get a chance to hear some of these brethren that had really were experts on various different things. Now I can get on my computer. Bob gave me something by Hugo McCord, and he said, look for that on the internet. It took me about 30 seconds to find it and read it. Well, it took me longer than that to read it, but it took me about 30 seconds to find it. It was online. It was there. You just go search for it and find these things. You know, and all of these guys from Pastor, there are places where some of those guys were dead and gone. We could hear their sermons. Wouldn't it have been great back then? If some of Paul's sermons, if some of Peter's sermons, aside, you know, we have some written records of them, but what if they had recordings of those? Wouldn't that have been great to hear some of those things? Even if they weren't the most eloquent of speakers that we talked about earlier. But just to hear what they said and how, we wouldn't understand it because it'd be in Greek, but those people, if they could have had that, what an advantage that would have been. They didn't have recording capabilities like we do. They had to write things down and they could and those kind of things. So we miss out sometimes on how blessed we are, and we just take it for granted, and we don't take advantage of those blessings to use them for God's kingdom. We need to work on that. And then number 7 is an evangelist to do personal work. Now certainly there were evangelists in the first century. We read of Philip. He was Philip the evangelist. He was an evangelist. But what we find is the church didn't try to turn over their responsibility for evangelism to one person and say, well, you do it for us. any more than they tried to turn over their praying or their giving or their study of the scriptures or their helping of the poor over to one person to do it for them. Everyone who was a Christian was out there trying to win souls. Acts 8 and verse 1, we find that when Saul had caused some havoc with the stoning of Stephen and then some persecution that followed that, it says the church all were scattered except the apostles. The apostles stayed in Jerusalem, but the rest of the church, a lot of them were scattered all over the countryside. And it says they went everywhere preaching the word and teaching that word to everyone all over the place. And the gospel spread as a result of that. But they didn't just, they had evangelists, yes. They had some people who had more time and ability and could focus on that and maybe even had some spiritual gifts that lent themselves toward being evangelists. But they didn't shirk their responsibility and say, well, I don't have to talk to anybody about Jesus because Philip's going to. Philip's the evangelist, so he's going to, and I don't have to. They didn't say that. They didn't live like that. And so, while it's great to be able to afford to hire someone who can spend their time focused on that effort, mathematically, one person's not going to save the world. It's not going to work. I did the math a few times in various places I've lived and try to see if the preacher had study after study after study, how long would it take him to reach to have a study with everybody in the county, assuming they were all willing. Obviously you can't make somebody study that doesn't want to. But if he could have a study with everybody, how long would it take him to study with everybody in the county? Well, he'd never get it done in his lifetime. But then I did the math again and I said, what if every person in the congregation had just one study with somebody this year? Just one. And that was successful and converted somebody. I know we can't always control whether somebody's converted, whether the gospel touches them and reaches them and pulls them to God or not. Sometimes it may drive them further away. That's true. But if everybody brought one person mathematically, and then the next year, of course, we'd double in a year, wouldn't we? We'd go from 80 to 100 to 160 to 200 in just a year. And then if that happened again the next year and the next, well, we'd reach the whole county in about 5 or 10 years. It wouldn't take that long at all to study with everybody. But when one person's out there trying to do it, it's not going to happen in their lifetime. So this idea is something that's a powerful thing that's shown in the New Testament. You go out, you teach others, and you teach them to teach others. That's what Paul taught Timothy. You entrust what you've heard from me. You entrust that to faithful men who will teach others also. We've got to keep passing it on. We can't let it die with us. And that's a danger that in every generation, I've heard say, well, the church is only one generation from apostasy. And that's true. It's actually less than that. I mean, it could be 1 week from apostasy if they wanted to go off the deep end. But the church is always only one generation from extinction in any community. It's just a matter of if we don't bring in new people to replace us, then when we're gone, it'll be gone. And that's all it would take to get rid of the church. And the study that was done, I don't know if it was a study, but the information that I saw about it shows that in the United States, there is a Church of Christ that closes every 6 days. One church closes every 6 days. That's one of the reasons that the effort to try to help the Hiwassee church, to help keep them going and to help them to get going and growing, is important. Because we don't want them to be one of those every 6 days that closes. In my first work when I was in Butler, Alabama, and, you know, we have the 21st Century Christian puts out the book Churches of Christ in the United States. It seemed like every year, and there weren't a whole lot of churches down there. When you hear Alabama, you think church on every corner, but that's Florence and Huntsville. But down in South Alabama where I was, the closest church to us was 40 minutes away. Okay, so I mean it was more scattered than we are here even. So even at that, it seemed like almost every year I was calling them to tell them about another church within 100 miles of us that had closed its doors and that they needed to remove from the directory because it didn't exist anymore. On one occasion, it was a good thing because two congregations merged. But the rest of the time, they became one congregation. It was a black church and white church merged together in one town, which was a wonderful thing. But for the most part, it was calling to say, yeah, you've got this church listed in here, they're not there anymore. And so we've got to be working together to bring the gospel in to everyone around us. And then we want to finish with this one tonight. Good prospects. We want the person who's already a good upstanding citizen, who's, you know, got a good job and got money and got a good family and maybe some kids if they're a younger family or whatever, you know, we want them to, oh boy, they really help the church out. We need to get them in here. And there's nothing wrong with trying to bring those folks in. But if we limit our evangelistic efforts to those good prospects, we're going to miss a lot of the people that are most likely to be interested in the gospel. What we found in the New Testament times is the kinds of people that they reached out to. Well, first of all, you know, you got Saul. Now, he was not a good prospect at all. He's the guy who's persecuting the church. And you know, I hear about that sometimes. Heard about atheists that were converted to Christianity. A guy I know up in Kentucky seems to be making some good inroads in among the Wiccans and Satanists up there where he lives. He's convincing them that they need to turn away from that and turn to Jesus, and that's amazing. But the poor, those that were outcasts, you know, the widows and the orphans. It's amazing when you look at church history and look back to those early years. You know, Rome was not the most compassionate of societies. And if a Roman family had a child that they didn't want, they'd just leave it to die. It wasn't that big a deal. You know, that's one of the things that we're fighting with right now in our culture, is to not become like that, because there are a lot of people who would kind of like that to be happening here. In fact, one of the governors in a state not far from here said something about that and stirred up a hornet's nest, which it should have, because the idea of, you know, having a child be born and then just leave it to die, I mean, not that it, you know, that's, I don't know if it, say it's worse than abortion, but it's certainly a horrible thing to even consider. But what happened was, when they left those children to die, the Christians went and found them. The Christians got those unwanted babies and brought them in and cared for them in a time when they were already struggling to feed themselves and to feed everyone else and to feed the widows and the orphans. They were taking in abandoned children. I think sometimes maybe we've lost a little bit of our love for the lost. We need to recapture that like they had it in the first century. How is it? Did they have problems in the first century? You bet. Were they perfect? No. They had all kinds of problems. And certainly not everybody in every church was doing these things that we're talking about anyway. But it was what they were known for. Their love and their compassion. and that they would take others in and care for them like that, and that they cared for each other. You know, that's what Jesus said. Jesus didn't say you're going to be known far and wide because you'll be the church that doesn't use instrumental music. That's not what he said. He didn't say you're going to be the church known far and wide because you take the Lord's Supper every first day of the week. He didn't say that either. Now we're studying about those things on Sunday morning, and I think they're important things for us to study and practice. But that's not what he said was going to be the telltale sign that we belong to him. He said, by your love for one another, all men will know that you're my disciples. If we do all those other things, but we don't have love, well, Paul explained what we are then. We're nothing. We're a clanging cymbal. We're a banging drum. If you've ever had kids who had a drum set, you know how annoying that is. We don't want to be the banging drum and the clanging cymbal and be worthless, useless to God. Our love is of such great importance. But we've got to look everywhere. We can't look over people and say, well, because of their nationality or because of their language impediment, or, you know, they speak with an accent, so we're not going to talk to them about Jesus, or their skin color, or they're poor, or, oh, they've got all sorts of problems in their life. Yeah, well, that's what Jesus does, is help us fix problems in our lives by turn our lives over to him and let him lead our lives instead of us trying to run it ourselves. I remember when I was just a kid in Colorado, there was a family that was converted out there and became active parts of the church. Their two teenage children were converted as well. And later on, they had some other children that wound up growing up in the church. But I remember when they were baptized and when they became Christians, someone said to my dad, you know, I've known him all my life. We grew up in the same town. I've known them forever. I never would have thought that he'd be interested in becoming a Christian. That's why that's not our job. It's not our job to decide who would be interested in becoming a Christian and who wouldn't. We're supposed to be seed sowers, not soil inspectors. The seed landing on those hearts, it'll determine whether that soil is good or not. We don't decide that ahead of time. In that parable of the sower didn't say, well, I'm not going to throw any seed over that way because there's rocky soil over there. Or I'm not going to throw any seed over there because there's a path down that way. He scattered the seed everywhere. And did some of the seed fall on that hard path and not produce anything? Yes, sometimes. Are we, when we talk to people about the Bible, when we invite people to church, when we ask somebody if they want to study the Bible with us, when we ask them a biblical question about something, are they sometimes going to not be interested and reject that? Sure. But that's not our job. It's not our job to decide whether they're going to reject it or not. That's their job. They can decide whether they're going to reject it or accept it. Our job is to present them with that opportunity. We certainly don't want to be among that group who on the day of judgment, as the song says, will have people coming up to us and saying, you met me day by day and you knew I was astray and you never mentioned him to me. We don't want to be a part of that group. We've got a few more of these that we'll look at in a future week, but I want us to think about these things that we consider. Are we taking full advantage of the blessings that God has blessed us with? Or are we kind of like those Israelites? We've kind of become complacent and at ease in Zion. We're just happy to be in here and, oh, I'm happy I'm a Christian. And, well, what about all the people that aren't? What about all the people that want to be, even if they don't necessarily know they want to be? They need to be. They need Jesus. And if we give them the opportunity, they might want Him as well. If you're here tonight and you have needs of prayer of the church for any reason, I ask that you come as we stand and as we sing.